Welcome to Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast. We've launched this series to explore all things education, from teaching to research to finding out why we're one of the leading departments in the country and the world. I'm your host, Heather Shirkunov, and unbelievably so, this is episode 5 in our series already. Today I'm thrilled to be joined by Professor Leon Feinstein, who, as of the beginning of this calendar year, started his 4-year tenure as the director of our department. Leon is a Professor of Education and Children's Social Care, and from 2021 to 2025 was the director of the RES Centre, a specialist research centre which focuses on children's social care. Leon's previous positions have included Director of Evidence at the Children's Commissioner's Office, Director of Evidence at the Early Intervention Foundation, and Chief Analyst in the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit in HM Treasury. Thanks for joining me today, Leon.
Hi.
So you've been in this new role for a few months now. How are you finding it?
It's great, I have to say. I'm really enjoying it. I wasn't quite sure what it was going to be like, but so far, so good, early days.
What are you hoping to bring to this role?
I think it's a wonderful department and it's a great thrill and honour to be in the role. I think what I can bring is helping us think a bit more about our relationship with the outside world. There's a lot of great research and a lot of great teaching, but I'm not sure we yet tell a really clear story for education, for those involved in teaching or in the policy making around education. What are our perspectives on the key issues? There are a lot of obviously big challenges in education. At the moment, it feels like we have a department that's grown quite quickly over a long time. I'm very mindful of the origins of the department, that we were created over 100 years ago to teach teachers and to do so based on the skill and science and knowledge of the wider university. So that's both our understanding of what teaching is as a cognitive process, as a process of learning and the support for learning. So psychology and related disciplines, understanding of the teaching process and the process of learning, but also the subject specialisms of geography or physics or whatever it is. And so I'm really interested in making connections across the university. That happens already, but can we do more of that and more explicitly base ourselves in the richest possible understanding of the latest study and research relating to those issues? And then particularly, what's our offer to teachers and ultimately to children? My career, you described a little bit, I was an academic for a long time. I did a PhD in economics and sort of transferred over into education, as some people do. I did work on early child development in economics at a time when people were interested in trying to understand the importance of early child development for later life. So that was a theme within labour economics, but obviously connects then to themes of education and development and so on. So I got more into an education field, and I did research for a government department, the Department of Education, and I became really interested in how the research got used. So then I moved from a university to work in government and the wider public sector. So a lot of my work has been at the interface between research and policy and practice in different ways. So I think what I can bring, sorry, this is a very long answer, what I can bring is, it's about storytelling. Although perhaps to many scientists, that sounds like a bad hand-wavy thing. But actually, it's how we understand what we do and what is our offer to the wider world. I think there are a lot of struggles in education at the moment. And I think for many children and young people, many of the things that I took for granted growing up are not as straightforward as they used to be. I think the labour market is very difficult. Obviously, the prices and housing and the economy. A lot of change, a lot of conflict, a lot of social breakdown, a lot of rights being taken away. It was something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. I grew up in a world in which rights were growing. The world was opening. And it feels now we've had a period in which rights have been taken away, rights to mobility, opportunity, and so on. So the big challenge is there. And I think as a department, we need to have an offer. So more than being a tremendous group of scholars and teachers, the question I want to ask is, what is the story we've got to offer to the wider world? And how do the concerns and interests of the wider world affect what we do and to support that dynamic externally?
It's an interesting point that you've touched on, that our department started off doing teacher training and just teacher training. And we should probably say a little bit more for our listeners about where we are now. We've also grown exponentially, as you've said, and we're now currently doing extremely well in different fields of research as well, and really getting a lot of recognition, including the Research Excellence Framework, and being a top player within that field. Can you outline where we are currently a little bit more to the audience?
Yeah, thank you. It's a good point. So I think only about 20% of our research and teaching is specifically now on teacher education. And a lot of the research that we do is about broader social science. It's very confusing, I think, outside the department. Why are we doing research on social science? What is education? And ultimately, as I said, in my career, I started as an economist. And a lot of people come to the subject of education to try and understand outcomes or life paths or the way society is functioning. There are so many questions within education that go beyond the narrow question of teaching. And that's challenging. The government has wanted to focus research into what happens in the classroom and how do we best support teachers to best teach children. But as social scientists, we realize that always happens in a wider context. So issues of housing and poverty and deprivation, migration and so on, identity and culture will be very important to how education plays out. So really, if we want to understand what's happening to children in the classroom or why they're succeeding or not succeeding, how we assess them, issues of curriculum and pedagogy and so on, we have to do that understanding that wider context. So the department has grown and a lot of our research is broader social science.
So how do you hope to influence the landscape of education in this role?
I think education is very politicized. I've had a 30-year career at the margins of education, really, doing research or policy making, not in schools directly as a teacher. But I've had a frustration throughout my career that the views about what works in education, what education is for, have tended to be dominated by quite prescriptive models of learning that are actually quite outmoded and outdated, in which we are setting a curriculum and a set of skills that we want students to learn that are pretty predefined, rather than a fire to be lit and a curiosity and a love for learning. I think that's quite dangerous in terms of where we go as a society and how we're preparing children for being successful in that wider world. But these are big debates within education policy. What is the purpose of education? And we had and certainly through the Blair years and the coalition years, there was a strong sense that we need a balance, but that we must remember that education is about training children for the labor market, and issues of discipline and behavior must be paramount. These are very politicized issues. I wonder where children's voices are in that. Some voices get heard, other voices don't get heard. And I think the voices of old politicians who have a instrumentalist view of education have dominated for too long. That does make me a fully paid up member of the blob. And I think it is a challenge for education research. How do we make a contribution, recognizing that education costs a great deal of money and the Treasury is concerned about, well, what do we get for that? How do we support economic growth? How do we support employment opportunities? Current Secretary of State, I think quite rightly, Bridget Phillipson, very focused on the labour market issues for children, trying to address inequality by trying to address opportunity and creating pathways for people to progress in the labour market. But I think if you limit your view of education to being about what is right for the labour market, you risk not only worsening your impact on the labour market because of the importance of art and culture and opportunity and agency and all of those themes. But I think education also has an important role supporting critical thinking, the capacity to challenge ideas, to challenge political ideas, to be a citizen, to enter public debate in an informed and meaningful way, and to support wider well-being and development. For a long time, there's been a debate around the Department for Education. To what extent should well-being be a concern of the education system? again, it's very difficult. Nobody wants to say that teachers should be psychologists or therapists or responsible for the individual well-being of children. But if we're not taking account of well-being, how can we be confident that we're supporting children in the right ways? And for a lot of parents, they're very concerned about how their children are in school. And these debates get, I would say, too politicized, so that we end up with narrow conflict or contrast between it's all about behavior on the one hand, or it's all about human expression and freedom on the other hand. Teachers are struggling with the relationship between those things. We want education, schools to be safe spaces for all children that are inclusive and support learning. And that means that there have to be rules and there has to be discipline, there has to be good behavior and so on. But how do we do that in a way that doesn't exclude large numbers of children, which is the current situation? So I think as a department, we ought to have a contribution on these topics, but we must do so on the basis of the strongest possible research, theory, and social science.
Speaking of research, you're currently the principal investigator on the Children's Information Project. So tell us a little bit about that project, and it obviously clearly also links into some of the themes of what you've just been discussing.
Very much so, about human agency and democracy and trust. This project, which is a big collaboration between a number of universities and a number of local authorities, and also Research in Practice, which is an organisation which works with local authorities to support their research and capability around research, funded by the Nuffield Foundation as a strategic project trying to address the strategic challenge of how do local authorities use children's information. So obviously with AI and machine learning and these kinds of issues, we know that local authorities collect and manage a lot of data about children and report that up to government. And there's issues like the national identifier, that every child should have an identifier so that all of their data can be linked when held within local authorities or governments to support research. But in a world of social media and technology, how should the information that children provide that is about them be used within local government? And there's a tension in the business end of that between those agencies that want data to be made available for their own use. So Instagram and Snapchat and so on will use the data that they hold about children. But social policy agencies are much more reticent and careful about how they use the data that children provide. And so there are a lot of tensions within all of that. It's quite a technical business. But within all of that, the challenge of this project is how are children's voices heard about what data is collected and how is it used? Not just children's voices, but also parents' voices, family voices, carers' voices, and the voices of practitioners. So it's a project about how information is used in local government, and trying to support both more voice of children and families and practitioners, those working closest with children, about how their data and information is used, and to weaken or make less dominant the voice of government in terms of what is collected and how it is managed. So this work came out of work I did in the Children's Commissioner's office, where Children's Commissioner was set up to support the voice of children and being heard in central government. But how do you hear the voice of 12 million children? What does that mean? How do we really support voice? Government collects a huge amount of data, but as the Children's Commissioner I work with, Anne Longfield, used to say, we know the age 11 math score of every child in state education. We don't know if they get beaten when they go home. We don't know very much about well-being. We don't know very much about how people are. For children in social care, for example, we know a lot about them in terms of where they are in the system, but we don't know whether they are well enough. We don't know often what support they need. In social workers may know, but in the aggregate, in terms of understanding what is really going on. So there's this tension between the desire to have more information so that we can answer questions like, how much should we spend on social care? If I can put a little story in here, I was working in the Treasury when austerity hit, and government departments were asked to find 40% reductions in their expenditure. And most government departments struggled with that. They did their best. At the time, the Department for Education was very gung-ho about how much it could cut from the children's social care budget, because there was the view, well, why do we really need children's social care? These are kind of moral problems and not issues in which government should intervene. So unusually in the Treasury, we had to work out, well, if we do cut more than 40% out of the children's social care budget, what will happen? And it was very hard to really model and understand that question. We don't have enough information to know how many children really need additional help beyond what their parents or universal services can provide. So it's just an example of why information can be very useful in government, but that means understanding what is the level of challenge faced by children in their lives, in their family lives particularly. What is the level of abuse or neglect or vulnerability to those things? And we don't have very much data on that as a society. I would have thought we would want to know how our children are in the round, but actually we don't know anything like as much as I think we should. So there is a case for having more and better information, but then how do we do that in a way that is ethical and that we're using the information in the right way? And local authorities are constantly dealing with that tension. This project is designed to help local authorities think about how to use information both ethically and integrating voice into that information and taking into account children's views and family views and practitioner views, but also ensuring that information is used effectively for the right ends, for the right purposes.
I would have thought, speaking on behalf of our listeners, that you would kind of expect that stuff was already happening, right? You would sort of expect all these different bodies were already talking to each other and there was more data. And if the data was there, it could be used by different entities. What gets in the way of that?
Well, so, you know, there is a lot going on. There's a lot of, you know, tremendous work that agencies do. You might think about the administrative data research, part of the Economic and Social Research Council, UKRI, that is supporting researchers to link all of the available data. But it's very, very difficult to do. There are big ethical challenges of doing it. And ultimately is limited by the issue of, well, what information do we actually collect? So we can link all of the data that we have. We still don't have very good answers to many of the challenges that I described. So every budget, every spending review, there's a question about how much do we need to spend on children's social care? And people are answering that based on, well, what have we spent previously? And what do we think will happen to the numbers of children going into care? Not based on an answer to the question, as I said earlier, what are the levels of need that we have as a society? And part of the challenge of that is, well, how do you define need? What are the thresholds at which we think the state should get involved? But fundamentally, the challenge is we don't collect the information. So, you asked the question, why don't we? I mean, there are a number of possible answers to that. One is it's quite technical and difficult, and it's not quite anybody's business. I should put a shout out to Josh McAllister, who as Children's Minister is trying to ensure there is data on the quality of relationships that children looked after have, which takes us beyond the existing body of information. One of the key things people want to know is, how are children? Are they loved? Are they supported? What is the quality of relationships that they have? Number one, that's not an easy thing to measure, but it's never been a routine part of government data collection. Government collects questions like, you know, what's the length of time that you've been going through this judicial process?
Yeah.
How many times have you seen your social worker? Not, are you loved? How do we answer that question? It's a great example of why we need good social science to start to get better information. But then you have this problem that the minister rightly pushes for this. Civil servants have to respond. They've got a narrow window of time in which to do it. And so something will be rolled out that's a very partial, incomplete measure. And the challenge for us in the university is to be monitoring that over the next decade. Do we end up with a bad measure that is retained in perpetuity because the next minister doesn't make it a priority? And because that's what you see in the data systems that we have, is the residual questions of previous ministers. And this is the core challenge. How do we get the best possible social science into the heart of government and keep people focused on the questions about the quality of measurement. It's a technical question.
Has your research always focused in this area?
I started out with I was doing a master's degree in economics, and I didn't believe that you could describe the world and people's experience of it through a set of equations. And I struggled a lot with that. And I started the master's thinking that I was going to try and critique economics and support it to have a better understanding of how human beings function and of the uncertainty within the way people operate, and the non-economic almost. I've been talking about relationships and the things people value. Often those go beyond the economics. I learned very early on nobody was interested in the critique, and ultimately what's more useful is to try and do research that I think does answer those questions. So that's been the agenda for me, is how do we understand? And it is actually quite challenging. A lot of our statistics, a lot of our ways of understanding are rooted in certain questions that have come with underpinning beliefs and values. And so relationships aren't implicit. A lot of the statistics people use, they're not relational. They're about making comparisons between people. They're not about understanding the relations between people. The dynamic interaction between individuals are quite hard to model in our statistics. So I've become much more interested in how do we do research that has the values and the purpose that I've been critiquing economics for not having. So I got into questions on which those kind of themes were relevant. I became very interested in child development and inequality. I'd say that's been the other kind of starting principle of my research. My father grew up in South Africa and came here in the 50s with a very strong sense of injustice, and my mother too. And it was sort of implicit that the question was always, how are you going to make a contribution? So I was interested in inequality within this country, and how do we understand that through relational understanding, bringing together those two themes. There's a kind of simple model of inequality where we just need better policy and then it will go. And I think that ignores the way relationships work, the way power works, that the elite and the powerful will seek to retain their power. Inequality emerges through a relational set of structures. So we need to understand those things. So I've been very interested in, these are methodological questions, but ultimately they're about how do we understand society and the place of the child within it and what the impact of society is on children and how do we make that fairer.
How has your thinking about education and inequality changed over the course of your career? You've touched on it there, but are there any big pieces that stand out? Do you think this was not what I was thinking 20 years ago?
I thought we might have made more progress. It is surprisingly difficult, and actually, in my lifetime, we've gone backwards in terms of levels of inequality, that we see in society in terms of income inequality, wealth inequality, equality of opportunity. I would say has gone backwards, and I think that is because it's not, and politicians struggle with this, but need to be reminded. It's not about, can you come up with a new initiative? It is about the structure of our society. It is the economy, the way technology is operating, the way power operates, the way privilege is hoarded. And so very difficult things really ultimately to challenge. Interesting to be saying all this in Oxford University. Right? So Oxford as an institution can try and be more inclusive, and has made big steps in that way, but is still not representative of the society it finds itself in. And I think that reflects this tension in inequality. We all want better opportunity for others, but nobody wants to give up their privilege. So we have to understand it in a relational way.
Find that that's a tension for you personally as well, that you're in this position, you're a director of a whole department, and as you say, at the world's leading, one of the top universities in the world, fighting for better equality for children as well. Do you find that as a tension, or do you think you're perfectly placed to try to tackle this?
Well, there is tremendous opportunity here, and because you can draw on the tremendous body of scholarship, and there's also the reputation and the ability to be heard that you have here that is not universal to the university sector. People, the relationship between the government of the day and Oxford University is surprisingly strong. It is an interesting fact, isn't it? That I think this is right. Apart from two, or possibly now three, all of our prime ministers since the war read PPE at Oxford. What's that about? And so it's both a tension and an opportunity. I think we have to be mindful of it, and it is about trying to be inclusive. I hope through our teaching we can be, we try to be as inclusive and make opportunities as much as we can. But then we operate in a market as well, so there's always that tension. How do we function as a business? We have to raise money, we have to charge fees. How do we do that and be as equitable as we can and address disadvantage, but also through our research? And so I think you have to use what you have. And Oxford has a great deal, so it does create a platform, and there's a lot of opportunity in that. But ultimately, we'll have to see how we do.
I'm curious whether it's important to you to keep your research going at the same time as these very high-level leadership roles.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really important so that I don't want to just be an administrator. I mean, I do love the job so far, and it is about supporting a tremendous group of scholars and educators and students to find their voices, to best express their voices, to have the best environment. It's one of the things I've enjoyed most in my career, actually, has been managing research teams and supporting teams to flourish. So I really enjoy that. But ultimately, I want to be doing research. That's why I came into university as a career. And it would be very sad to me if I didn't keep that going.
Have you got further career goals, or do you tend to stay in the here and now, just sort of thinking bigger picture about your career?
I certainly didn't come here to be director of the department, head of the department. I didn't think that was going to happen. So I like to be responsive to how things go. I'm towards the end of my career. This may be my last job. I really want it to work. I'm very committed to it. I want to see the department flourish and the people in it, and I'm very excited about that. Beyond that, there are some issues in my own research that I feel the need to go back to and complete, and it's important to me I retain that as a goal. Some of these issues around inequality and the way beliefs work around inequality, I was very struck during the years in which Dominic Cummings was a big force in policy making. He was one of those who argued that genetics was strongly implicated in social class inequality. And I think that's a misinterpretation of what we're learning from genetics about how development works, about how society works. But there are a lot of research questions around that topic that I think need to be addressed. And ultimately, I thought that was a wrong-headed view and a misleading view, the view that the elite are the elite because they are genetically superior. I think we ought to be able to disregard that view, and I found it astonishing that people were claiming a scientific foundation for that view, but the response of science to that view was quite weak. And I think there's a lot to do to marshal better the understanding that we are, that biologists and genetic scientists and others are, what they are learning about how people function, the way development works, but how that links to issues of social structure needs much better public debate. And I do want to go back to that question before I retire.
From looking at your previous work, it seems as though you're just as passionate, if not more so, about impacting the policy as much as the academic outcomes. Why is that so important? Where has that come from? Where has that drive come from?
I guess my family, I don't really know. I mean, I had a strong sense of my father as somebody who, age 18, was outside the mines in Johannesburg selling the Communist Daily News and trying to persuade people to to stand up for their freedom. And he always struck me as somebody who had a very strong sense of that value and the importance of that. And I never quite knew, I mean, he grew up in Johannesburg, South Africa. I grew up in Cambridge, England. I didn't really know how to translate that into the environment in which I grew up. And it took me a while, but that was really an important goal for me, was to understand how, with the set of attributes that I have and the limitations that I have, what contribution could I make? That was always the question. And I think I learned that, you know, that contribution was through research. But I never wanted to do research just for the enjoyment of that or the scientific value of that, important though those things are. But ultimately, I was interested in how the world works and how we address the unfairness in it. I think it was probably quite a formative experience for me at university. I'd been in state schools. I hadn't seen the public school system, really. I wasn't really aware of it. And then university life, I went to Bristol University. It was very dominated by public school children. And I was quite shocked to see quite how that worked, the way our society worked. And I saw children in the schools that I'd been at who were just as bright, just as able, but who didn't see education as something that they wanted or something that they would follow. And it's not just education. It was all the privileges that came with that of 3 years living away from home, in those days supported by the state. There was tremendous opportunity in that and an opportunity to develop and travel and do all kinds of things. And it wasn't fairly distributed. And that bothered me.
What did your parents do over here then for a living?
My mum was a teacher for a while. She was a maths teacher through particularly my early childhood. She moved away from that because she didn't really like the way the education profession was going in terms of national curriculum and what was expected of teachers. She wanted more autonomy. She wanted more creativity around how children understand maths, and that the way the world evolved wasn't for her. And she ended up doing a number of things, but she's still going, age 90, supporting schools that are there for children who won't go to school because they are bullied in their existing schools. So she's stayed around the education system. My father was a historian, an economic historian, my dad, and he ended up in Oxford. He came to Cambridge in 1953 to do a PhD in economics. And he had a career in the British university system doing economic history.
Sounds like big influences up from both sides then. It kind of tracks when you talk about your career and some of your interests.
Yeah.
Have you got siblings and did they?
I have three sisters.
Oh.
Who all influence in their different ways.
Yeah.
By those relationships and objectives. My elder sister is now a genealogist. She does a lot of family history. So she'd be much better able to answer these questions.
So we've talked a little bit about tension, and I'm curious how, as a researcher, as an academic, how you navigate the tension between what the data and research might say, but what the policymakers want to hear.
Well, that's a great question, and that is something I have learned through my career. I think I've always wanted to stay close to the data. I think I've been quite frustrating to politicians in the business of bringing evidence to policymaking. I worked at the Early Intervention Foundation, maybe a good example, where the Early Intervention Foundation was set up to provide local authorities with better evidence about how to do preventive work with children. So early intervention, not just early years, but in the sense of preventive activity, before situations get endemic children are in the criminal justice system. How do you intervene earlier in preventive ways? And local authorities wanted better evidence about how to do that. And I think they found me as director of evidence possibly a bit frustrating because the evidence wasn't always there. It's a really important principle, early intervention, but it's quite a difficult thing to establish an evidence base for. I think we know enough to know that it can work and it should work. But I ended up taking quite a critical perspective on some of what there was out there. I mean, what I tend to say is that saying, does early intervention work, is a bit like saying, do shoes fit?
Right.
It really depends on the shoe and the foot. And, you know, what do we mean by early intervention? There are thousands of different activities. The difficulty with that is I didn't want to let government off the hook, in the sense that there is a case, there is certainly a very strong case that governments should invest and support preventive activity. That case is very well established, and they don't do enough of that. But that's not the same as saying we know exactly what any local authority should do in any circumstance. And so it's a really good example, I think, of the challenges of bringing evidence to bear in policymaking. Because you're caught between, exactly as you say, between the tension of wanting to give certainty and then being honest about the reality. And if you get that balance wrong, you stop being useful, you stop being valuable. You might be, you know, if you're constantly emphasizing the certainty, you might be useful, but you're misleading. And so I was very conscious of that in my work in government. And I was very lucky, really, to work in a delivery unit. This was under the time of Gordon Brown, when the government did want the truth. That was what they saw the role was, in trying to understand the extent to which government was being successful in meeting its social policy objectives. They didn't want brown coating. And so that was a good environment to be in. But it really depends on the political environment, whether people are willing to hear what the data are really saying. And I think that's ultimately why I moved away from engaging too directly with politics. And why, again, I'm, you know, really privileged and fortunate to be in a place like Oxford University, where we can stay very close to rigor and meaning and accuracy and honesty. And if the politicians don't come, they don't come. And you know, we've got to get that balance right. I think most politicians want that. So it's not just about whether you're offering false or accurate certainty or uncertainty, but also about storytelling, about the degree to which you can make the connections and help people understand what is known and what isn't known. And it's also about the questions that you set. One of the big challenges of bringing research into policymaking is that policy is always way ahead of research. The questions are always moving on. So, you know, we have these nice models that we do the research and then we tell the politics what we learn from the research. But by the time we get there, the politics has moved on always. The questions that the leading politicians are asking are at the cutting edge of where social science and other research is. Pandemic was a great example of that. We didn't have the answers about how do you manage society through, you know, lockdown, and what are the right models in terms of how people are going to behave. Maybe 15 years from now, we might have much better answers to those questions for the, you know, but it was a bit late. There's always that challenge. So it's about being able to move at pace and having a sense of what's honest and good enough and useful without overselling. And that is attention.
It's really interesting because previously on other episodes of Education Explored, we've been talking about the issues of AI moving so quickly. And it sounds very similar to the sorts of themes that you're talking about now, that to do proper research, you need time, you need evidence, you need data, you need to be able to look at it. And by the time you've produced that report or whatever it might be, sometimes it's moved on. And is there any way to bridge that gap?
It's a great question. I mean, ultimately, I think we need to stay true to the timelines and the purposes of research. And there are many great researchers who've completely ignored government and they just work on their material, they work on their study, and maybe 30 years later it achieves impact because society has moved back towards the question that they were addressing. They're doing foundational research, and there's a really important role for that. I think that's part of the challenge of thinking about what social science projects should we do, that if everybody's just operating at the frontier of where government is, there's no foundation to that, and ultimately it won't lead to a successful corpus of research. We need foundational research that might be quite a long way away from where government is, which is why it's good that, you know, the Economic and Social Council Research Councils, you know, has curiosity-driven research as well as mission-oriented research. That is the debate within research funding, and you need the right balance. But at the same time, I do think universities have a responsibility to stay close to the questions. And not every researcher, but that we risk losing legitimacy if we're seen as just doing research for ourselves. So, yeah, there are big tensions and issues in the question you raise. I don't know the answer.
What do academics most misunderstand about policymaking and vice versa?
I don't know if it's still true, but I used to feel that a lot of academics were working on the question of what should government care about. which is not that that's not an important question, but nobody's listening. You know, how as an academic do you situate yourself in a democracy where a government is elected and is setting a set of priorities? What is then your contribution to how the government thinks about those priorities? If you're just saying these are the wrong priorities, you're just not going to be heard. And perhaps too much of our research has been, an academic debate has been in closed rooms. I find it very frustrating to be in academic meetings where people are talking about what word shall we use for something in the seminar room in Oxford. And I'm thinking, well, what is the language that they're using, you know, across the rest of the country in real life? And so I think there's a danger of being in these privileged closed spaces and thinking that our conversations really matter when they don't. And I'd say the other thing with academics, all of us, we tend to forget that we're a specialist in one thing. I see a lot of academics who start to think that they have expertise across the board, and then they become much less informative. So knowing what your specialism and knowing what your offer is, I think, is really important, and staying close to that. I think in terms of what politics doesn't understand about research, I think it's more it doesn't care, and maybe it shouldn't. But my worry is that politicians think they understand social science. You don't get politicians designing nuclear power stations.
Yeah.
But they do think they can design the school system. And that's, you know, everybody's been at school. Everybody has a sense of what a school is. They've sent children to school. They've gone. So they think they know what it is. And obviously, in a sense, they do. And I think it's a big challenge for social scientists to help people understand why there's additional value in a social scientific understanding of things that people think they already know. But I do think that's a big part of the problem of how social policy works in this country.
It's interesting when you were just saying then about academics in a room talking about what they should call a certain thing, but as you say, not really having understanding or not really knowing what the rest of the country is saying about that topic, or using, you know, whatever the name for that topic would be. It strikes me that that's what most people think about politicians.
Right.
That they're stuck in a room somewhere in Whitehall making decisions or making names for things when they don't really understand what people actually out in Britain are calling these things or their interaction with it. Is that your experience?
No, I mean, maybe I have a naive view, but I mean, politicians are accountable in a very direct way to their electorate on the whole. Most politicians are regularly meeting constituents, and they have a very, very good sense of the reality. And not all, but most politicians, I think, have a really strong sense of the realities on the ground. The challenge is, how do you translate that into effective policy?
Yeah.
And that's not about, you know, I think people are wrong to think politicians are necessarily out of touch. Maybe they lose touch a bit. You know, if you're stuck in the bunker in Downing Street, maybe you end up with a bit of a closed circle talking to itself. But in general, I would say politicians struggle more with the question of knowing the reality doesn't help you know what's actually going to make a difference. The course that I teach in the department is about the implementation of the rights of children, which comes from my time in the delivery unit, where we're faced with the question not what should the government be aiming to do, but how is it doing in that aim and how can it do better? And I'm very interested in that in relation to child rights, not the question, what should children's rights be, but how are we doing in realizing them? What are the levers available to us? And I do think that's a big part of the problem of public debate around policy, the sense that we're not getting the results we want because politicians must be corrupt or venal or incompetent, rather than because actually, we don't know how to do those things. People just assume that government can do what it wants. Well, you know, it can do certain things. It could build a huge hole in the centre of the country if it wanted to. But, you know, can it make a well-functioning society? And what's, you know, that's not in the gift of government. So ultimately, it is about, again, democracy and trust and the relationship between state and individuals and community groups and creating the right dynamic. And so I think part of the frustration that people feel at politicians is just the limitations of political capability.
Given all of the roles that you've done in your career, how have those roles changed the way that you think about influence and responsibility?
I've been very lucky, I suppose, to get into roles as a researcher in which I am in conversations with sort of politicians and policymakers and at local and national government levels. I feel like I've never had power, but I've seen it and I've seen the way it operates. And what I found difficult about that, I suppose, is the pace at which decisions have to be made, the way they have to be made with incomplete information, the tremendous consequences that ensue. It's a tremendous responsibility that politicians carry. And as an academic, you kind of want 5 years to think about the problem and understand it in all its ways, and people having to make very rapid decisions. That said, I do think the system takes over a bit from what our potential might be. I think too often people get caught up in the rhetoric, and maybe that's because of the tremendous responsibility, the burden of it, that people have to defend what they decide. They need to have a good argument. They need a good line. And sometimes a good line counts more than the truth. And that's quite hard to see operating. I would really like to see more of the debates that go on in a spending review made more public. It feels like people get to vote every 5 years and then politicians go into a closed bunker for a year and come out with some decisions. And that hasn't changed in 20 or 30 years. And I think, as I was saying, part of the people's frustration is they can't understand why we don't get the results that everybody says they're going to get. Is it because politicians lie? Politicians don't know. They don't know how to deliver those things. And it feels like there's too much of a presentation of capability rather than an honest dialogue about what the limitations are of what we can do. But that is the political process, I suppose.
Potentially, I think we've hit the nail on the head of what the issues are there. And you're quite right that maybe the public doesn't know enough what goes on behind closed doors. Probably we don't want to know everything, but it might be useful just to know a little bit more about how the decisions are made or the limitations, like you say, because I think people are much more understanding when they know, well, these are the parameters of the decision I've had to make and this is why we're doing it.
I don't understand why we don't have more citizens' panels, juries, looking at the things that ministers are looking at during a spending review and understanding the trade-offs that are being made and that there aren't easy answers. You know, why can't we make everybody richer? You know, why can't we deal with the cost of living crisis? Why can't we have good enough investment in public services? Why are the potholes so bad and all the rest of it? The trade-offs are really difficult. And I it does feel like we still have a slightly patrician government that wants to stand above society rather than engage society. I don't understand why that hasn't changed in 30 years.
So I was going to ask you what you find most challenging about your profession, but I think there's a question before that. If I am to meet you for the first time, what do you introduce yourself as? Do you first of all say you're the director of a department, or do you say you're a professor of education or you're a researcher? What is the first thing that you kind of would introduce yourself as?
I tend to say now I'm professor of education and children's social care. I used to say I'm an academic, and then I had a hairdresser, a barber I went to. He asked me, I'm an academic. He said, what does that mean? I said, it means I work in a university. He said, oh, if I was a cleaner in your university, could I call myself an academic? And I thought, well, fair point. So I try and be more specific now. I do. I say I'm a professor of education and children's social care. And either the conversation stops at that point or not.
What do you find most challenging about that role?
That was very tough. I mean, I was working at the Children's Commissioner's Office. I'd done work in Treasury on how the funding of social care was working and what levels were necessary or required. But I've never been in care. I've never been a foster parent. I've never been a social worker. And it's a field in which experience is really important. And that's both practically in terms of understanding how the system works and in terms of credibility and value. I think that there's a very powerful and important movement within the world of care that is about experience and the voice of those who have experience of the system having more weight and influence. So being, you know, my view was I could come in and support as a researcher, as an academic, trying to bring methodologies and approaches and understanding from other parts of research and other bits of social policy. And to a degree, that's been useful. But ultimately, I think I am, you know, that is always a limitation I'm aware of. I also think it's quite a difficult thing to bring evidence to bear on. We seem to have a very poor public debate, in my view, about care and issues of abuse and neglect and so on. So either nobody's talking about it, or there's a terrible case involving an infant death, in which case everybody's talking about it. But what's happening, and we see this with Epstein, just blame is being thrown around. And it's about the avoidance of shame. And you know, blame and shame are very powerful dynamics. And obviously issues of abuse and poverty and neglect and all these things come with these components. And too much of our political debate, I think, is about the avoidance of those things rather than really dealing with the problems. And you know, if I can draw the parallel to Epstein, you know, it's amazing how much public discussion there is being about this, but who's actually, you know, progressing prosecution against the perpetrators. But at the same time, you see, you know, all kinds of people being drawn into it because blame and shame get thrown around. And I really wish, you know, it is very difficult. But how are we going to deal with issues of abuse or neglect if we're just blaming and shaming? We end up with an escape from accountability, which is also what drives a lot of our politics of the topic. It is about nobody wants to be responsible for a child death, quite rightly, but ultimately those in power have to be responsible. So part of the struggle for me has been about that. How do we have a better public discussion about these themes that isn't just rapid going straight into blame or shame, but is actually trying to be honest and accurate about what is going on? And that's also hard because people don't want to really deal with a lot of those realities. So there's sort of avoidance of the detail. And so I think it comes back to the theme of voice and how we give more voice to those who've been in the system, but then also work out ways in which the system can improve. Again, it comes back to this issue of, well, what are the means and mechanisms by which policy can actually improve things?
From a personal perspective, what have some of your highlights of your career been?
I was very fortunate early in my career that some of my PhD research was seen as useful or important, was valued, and I got invited into government, and I found that very exciting. I was very interested in what government was and how it worked. This was the early days of the Blair government. And so there were highlights there in terms of, I didn't meet Blair actually, but with Gordon Brown, got to know a little bit, you know, and had that sense of understanding what was going on and being invited into the rooms in which decisions were made. There were highlights there. But I don't know if other academics feel this. I'm mainly left with a sense of incompleteness, or I won't say failure exactly, but you kind of ultimately what you can achieve is so limited in terms of the ideas you start out with. I've described, wanting to understand the way society operates and how inequality is generated, and 30 years on, who can have an impact on that? You can't expect that any one of us, or even a whole society, so it is limited, but maybe you start with unrealistic expectations. But that kind of dominates for me is with the years I have left. It's not that I want to make a difference so much now. I think I have more of a awareness of how limited what impact you can really have on it all is. And I do want to go back into making a contribution through supporting an education department to better support the education of children ultimately, and to complete the research that I wanted to do that I've kind of been distracted from through my career.
Even though the impact you say is limited, it still must be hugely important to still do it, and also as a collective, because as you say, if anybody's going to change some of this stuff, presumably it'll be a department like ours.
I think, you know, at the level of an institution, you can make a difference. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is important to focus on what, I learned this in government, on what you own. You know, what are the things that you really have scope and capacity to do? And so as an education department, you know, we're a relatively large department. We have a, you know, huge array of talented researchers, and we educate teachers, and we do a lot of research. And question for me is, how ultimately then are we influencing the education system and research in education? To what extent are we really improving research, and to what extent are we supporting the delivery of better outcomes and experiences for children? And I think that's a great question to focus on, and I think we struggle to answer it very cogently, but I think if we focus on it a bit more, we might be more successful in understanding what we do through that lens, and maybe having a degree of impact within a wider world.
And is that the message to early career researchers? Know your field, know what you're working with, know who you're working with, make as much impact as you can, and be realistic around that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely a danger in getting involved in the world of policy, and thinking you're having a lot of impact, but you're just being swept along in the current. But I don't want to dissuade people from trying to do that. I think it's really important. The danger is that ambition gets turned into being used. It's well known, you know, governments want to find a particular finding, so they'll find the researcher that will find that finding. And you might think, well, you know, I'm doing great research, but actually you're just the you know, flavor of the moment. And so all researchers, all academics will and ultimately have to have integrity and authenticity. And I do think that, as you say, comes from being really clear about what your offer is. What is your real knowledge and insight, and not moving too far away from that. Difficulty of that, though, is if you can't engage in a wider conversation, you won't be able to make that offer. So you do have to be open to other questions and engage with the process if that's what you want to do, but don't lose touch with what is the heart of your knowledge.
Thinking about the education sector as a whole, what are some of the biggest challenges you foresee in the next few years?
Well, so I do worry about where we've got to on child rights in education. I do feel the system has become increasingly instrumentalist, where we are on behaviour and inclusion. I think huge challenges for the education system around inclusion. We have a long since Baroness Warnock report and a focus on inclusion being at the heart of the system. And I'm afraid to say austerity and education policy since that time broke inclusion. We now have multiple forms of exclusion that are very detrimental to the life chances of many children. But how do we deal with that when the education system itself is quite excluding and instrumentalist? It's not to say teachers are and heads are. There are a lot of schools and teachers working incredibly hard to be inclusive, but the system itself doesn't reward inclusion as much as it should. Let's see what happens through the wellbeing bill and so on. But so that, I think that is a huge challenge. It's obviously the related issue of children with special educational needs and disabilities, many of whom are through their parents or through reality having to be educated outside of the mainstream. And so again, we lose inclusion, and the consequences are very difficult for children, families, and for schools. So how do we rebuild inclusion? Is a I think, a big challenge. I do think that has to be related to issues of well-being and development and the question of what schools are for and how we build schools that are communities and not just factories of learning. It's a blob question, but ultimately that is key to, for many children who are not going to school or going partially, emotional-based school avoidance is about the experience that they have in the school. And so we have to think about the question in the round. So there's that. There's obviously AI is a big challenge. How we do education assessment is a big challenge. And our department's thinking about that question, and obviously as are many. And I think we need to think about what our answer is to that. Where are we in relation to skills and what we want children to get from their learning and from their time in school? I mean, the technology is obviously a big driver of the labour market and how we supporting children to flourish in the world that they go out into. These are big challenges.
I think AI has come up in every single episode so far of the series. From a personal perspective, what are your thoughts on it? Do you enjoy it? Do you like it? Do you hate it? How do you feel about
all of
AI?
All of those? definitely. I mean, I'm not a technophile. I'm not an early adopter of technology. My view, you know, Heidegger talked about, you know, technology is about, ultimately it's about your relationship to nature, rather than being a set of, you know, gadgets. But I think AI does present huge challenges to us. I generally would say use it or be used by it. I think we have to confront it. I worry about the ownership of it. I worry about the political economy of it. I was delighted to see the Prime Minister of Italy talk about the challenges for Europe of you know, why are we so dominated by a set of corporations in America and how we, or China or wherever, how do we democratize it? These are challenges politicians need to step up to. I think they're a long way behind. And I think there's too much of a focus on the benefit for the economy without thinking about the challenges to our democracy and the value of our society. So that, yeah, like everybody, I'm caught on these hooks, but it is tremendously useful. Anybody who's used it, I worry as a head of an education department when students are using it to write their essays and we're using it to mark them. I mean, what is this process? Obviously, that's going to have to change. Is changing. And there are really interesting discussions going on there. So, yeah, I tend to try and encourage people to use it because we need to understand it.
What are some of the opportunities in education that we can influence as a department in the near future?
I think the department has a tremendous and a deeply well-founded model of teacher training, of teacher education. That does have the whole child at its heart and the learning experience at its heart and learning as a fire to be lit, not a vessel to be filled. And I think that's a really important message that we should stay close to. It's a tremendous capability that the department has. We also have great scholars of the different disciplines involved in that, of maths education, of linguistics and so on. And I think there are tremendous opportunities in trying to make sure that we really sustain that model of learning and continue to be a voice for it.
A lot of the stuff we've talked about today is quite complex, quite heavy.
Yes, yeah,
sorry. Not at all. It's very interesting. I suppose my question is, how do you switch off from that? What is your ideal non-working day when you're away from the department?
I run. Which is great for mental health. It's just so good. I get out and I forget everything, and I process it. You know, I might leave work cross and I'll, you know, go for a run and it's all fine. I also, as my family and friends would tell you, I like a round of frisbee golf.
Oh, I was not expecting you to say that.
For those which I presume everybody knows what that is, but
I think I do.
It's something I picked up in America.
Do you have holes like a golf course?
You have baskets instead of holes. So there are baskets where they have a pole at the heart of it, and you have to kind of hit the pole and fall in the basket with a disc. And it's just like BS golf, as we call it, ball and stick golf. except frisbees going into baskets instead of balls into a hole. And the obstacles are in the air because you're flying the frisbees through the air. And I met a psychologist who I worked with who was a very good player. And he took me out to play. And he threw this frisbee sort of 300 feet and it skipped on the wind. And I just really wanted to be able to do that. And I'm 10, 20 years later, I'm still learning.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for your very precious time. You can find out more about Leon and our department on the website education.ox.ac.uk. Join us again next time for another episode of Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast.